Someplace around here. Oh, yeah. Introduce the speaker. The speaker is my sponsor, and it just dawned on me I have to say something nice. Oh, my God. Give me a minute. No, actually, Mike is the speaker tonight. He came through Ridgeview in 1990. He's remained sober ever since. I had a sponsor before Mike, and I had him for 9 years, and he moved away, and I had to find someone new, and I see Mike on Sunday mornings at the men's meeting at Easy 123 in Duluth, and that's my home group, and I asked him on a spiritual retreat if he'd be my sponsor, and he said, yeah, and together since April, we've been together, so. And Mike has a great story, and his wife Moni is here. Thank you, and I'll introduce you, Mike. Mike S.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. By the way, you never realize how short the readings are until you're the speaker that evening. Before I start, I was curious. I decided to do this at the last minute. How many people here tonight are here as, what are they called these days? Inmates or patients or customers? Oh, great. That's wonderful. Because I was one of you. I'll probably spend more time tonight talking about Ridgeview than I should or than I normally do. But this is where the miracle started for me. I ended up here on October 25th, 1990. Cottage A, and I remember sitting, they didn't know what to do with me, so they put me in that, I don't know if they still have it, it was a meeting area between the two wings, and I sat there conflicted. You know, one, it was, I couldn't believe that I ended up in a state-licensed mental facility. That was one thought. And the other was, thank goodness, I'm finally going to do something about my drinking. And I don't remember a lot about the first couple of days. I don't know what they gave me to detox me, but it was good shit, whatever it was. I do remember going to a meeting on the cottage, and I assume they do those kinds of things still, but that's what we called it, going to a meeting on the cottage. And it must have been like Friday night or Saturday night, you know, when I had come through enough to know what was going on. And I remember two things about that meeting. One is that they asked me to read the traditions, and I knew how to say the word anonymity, and I was so proud of myself. And the second was I picked up a white ship. And do they still lock people up? Because that's what they did to me. I was locked up on the cottage. I couldn't go any place for, I don't remember how long. It wasn't real long, but I had to pass some tests or get some approval or something. And my first meeting off the cottage was in this very room. And my recollection, the room was bigger. They must have changed something, because either that or in my, you know, over the years it's gotten perverted or changed. And I remember two things about that meeting. One was I was sitting out there. I was actually sitting right down on this side toward the back, you know, where the patients usually sit. And they were picking up 30-day chips. You know, I was probably 4 or 5 days sober at that time, and they were picking up 30-day chips. And I remember so clearly, I could not imagine, couldn't fathom going 30 days without putting up all of my body. So if there's anybody else that has had that thought, you know, I can identify with you. The other is that they asked me to come up and pick up an alumni white chip. And I did that. And I still have that white chip. I have all my original... with one exception, I have my original alumni chips. We did an intervention on one of my brothers, and I'll probably talk about that. I can tell you one of the great insights I had, that if you have a choice, it's much better to give an intervention than to get an intervention. But I gave him my one-year chip, and then I had to come back and pick up a second one. But outside of that, I have my originals, and I have that original white chip that I picked up on the cottage. And it's funny where I keep them. and again, I don't know if they still do this, but this, when I was here, it was like going to the real hospital, and they gave us a little MSS basin and plastic cup and I think a wash basin. And so when I got home, I had those things, and I have kept my chips over the years in a little plastic cup, and I still have that. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about why I'm here. I really have no intention of making any broad generalizations about how AA works or why it works or, you know, the history of AA or anything like that. What I want to do is I want to tell you my story. I want to tell you about my descent into hopeless alcoholism, what happened to me, how I got sober, and what my life is like now. I was born in 1946, November 10th in 1946, in South Minneapolis. I was the oldest son of six boys, by the way. My parents ended up having six sons. Of a working class Irish Catholic family. And, you know, I find this interesting. I talk about this a lot. When I finished Ridgeview, I guess it might have been all the groups and all the psychologists, and you know, but I was looking for the reason that I was alcoholic. And I tried as hard as I could to blame my childhood. I wanted to be a victim, I guess. And the reality is, I had an idyllic childhood. I was safe, I was loved, I was protected. There was just nothing wrong with my childhood. If anything was broken, it was me. I had one adventure when I was... I tell this story, too. If there's one thing an Irish Catholic mother with six boys wants, it's for one of them to be a priest. They want that very badly. And when I was in my mid-teens, they asked me, "Have you ever thought about being a priest?" And I said, "Yeah, I thought about it." Whoom! 72 hours later, I was on a bus to Carthage, Missouri, and I spent a year in a Catholic seminary, the better part of a year. And it was a very, very surreal experience. The only way I can describe it to you is that it's like I read about it in a novel some time ago. And I know what happened to me, but it's that kind of surreality that I just... And the reason I bring that up, I mean, some funny things happened. The women that served as the food. Monique taught me about lunch lady arms, hang down. She doesn't have them. That's my wife. But the women that served us the food, I'm not going to stand up here and say they were ugly, but they did make celibacy seem like an attractive option. I think that all of us have big years in our life. That's where I'm going to start. My big year was when I was 18. I met the two great passions of my life when I was 18. There was a dance at the Marion Hall in Bloomington, Minnesota. That's a suburb of Minneapolis, south. And I had a girlfriend at the time, and I think I'd had a fight with her. And so one of my friends had to get this, a bottle of Muscatel wine. And I drank the whole thing. And nothing much happened for about 15 minutes, and then the miracle happened. And we all have experienced that. All of a sudden, I was bulletproof. All of a sudden, I could stand up to bullies. I could talk to girls. I could dance with girls. It was wonderful. I overshot the mark that night, and I overshot the mark most nights. But I overshot the mark that night, and I remember the Bloomington police dragging me out by my heels, banging my head down the stairs. And the next thing I remember is, it's the middle of winter in Minnesota, by the way. This is late November. And they were afraid I was going to barf in their police car, so they rolled the window down, stuck my head out the window, and rolled the window up again. I was sick, really, I was sick, deathly sick for 3 days. That's the first hangover, that's the first time I ever got drunk. That's the first hangover I ever had. And I remember I couldn't wait to do it again. I literally couldn't wait to do it again. Now, later in the year, actually it was October, it was Halloween, I went to Bloomington. I was invited to a party, and I had a date earlier in the evening, and she was pretty young, and I had to get her home at some reasonable curfew. So I think I showed up at this party around midnight. That's the best of my recollection. And I remember I walked up these stairs, and as I turned into the room, there was a couch. And on the couch was the prettiest girl I'd ever run into. She had long, straight, blonde hair, Mary Travers of Peter, Paul, and Mary, that look. And I walked up to her, and I said, are you with anybody? And she looked at this guy next to her, and she said, no. And I had no idea that I had just met the love of my life. Moni and I have been together ever since. That was Halloween of 1965. I put her through hell. We had a whirlwind romance. What I'm going to talk about next is not a big deal today, but I want you to remember this was now 1966. I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but Moni got pregnant. And that's not what girls did in 1966. You know, for the young people here, they used to have homes for unwed mothers, and girls would get pregnant and they would just disappear. And they'd show up 6 months later, you know, and nobody would talk about it. And we decided that we would get married. It was actually kind of sad. Both my parents and her parents were quite ashamed that their oldest children did this. And the wedding, it wasn't until I was a little older I realized how hard it was on Moni, you know, because she had grown up, you know, and a woman's wedding day was the big day of her life, and her mother handled everything, and she had almost no input. We weren't even allowed to invite our friends. It was just something we did that we had to do to get through legally. That'll play a role a little later in my story. And I think this is important. Now, our son was born when I was 20, or we were 20. This 18-year-old thinking, it was important to me that I date a younger girl. Moni is 10 days younger than I am. When I was 20 and 21, alcohol worked for me. You know, I've heard these stories about people that knew from the first time they drank that they were in trouble. They were instantly alcoholic. That was not the case with me. Alcohol worked for me, and it probably worked for a decade. Now, when I look back at my life, I didn't drink all the time, but the part that I remember now is when I did drink, I tended to get drunk. You know, I didn't understand it. I didn't understand it later on when I was drinking every day, but I didn't understand it then. But through my 20s, alcohol as such was not a problem. But there was a problem with alcohol, and I'm going to be brief about this, but it's an important part of my story. Anthony Weiner would call them inappropriate relationships. I entered into some of those. And I was young, I was self-centered, I was selfish. But I knew what was right and wrong. You know, my church and my parents and my teachers had all conspired to give me a well-honed sense of morality. I absolutely knew right from wrong. I always did. But the miracle of alcohol was that it gave me permission to do what I knew was wrong, but I wanted to do anyways. And then when the guilt came, and the guilt always came, alcohol was great for suppressing it. And so I got into this cycle. The more I drank, the more I acted out. The more I acted out, the more I needed to drink. And that progressed throughout my 20s. Now, when I was 29, alcohol was starting to become a problem. By this point, I was pretty much a daily drinker, but I would drink in bars. You know, I was the life of the party, by the way. I was the guy. Do they still have piano bars? I don't know if they do or not. They do. It'd be the middle of the summer in Minneapolis, and my friends and I would meet at a piano bar, and I was the guy that had everybody singing Christmas carols because that's the only songs people knew the words to. Alcohol was still working, but it was becoming a problem. And I came to Atlanta on an assignment. I came down here. I was in the IT business. And there was a fledgling company that was in a lot of trouble. And I worked my butt off. I worked for, I think, 13 or 14 days. And I was working 16-hour days. And I turned the company around. And on the way to the airport, the owner asked me, If they gave me half the company, would I come down and run it? So I went back to Minneapolis. This will give you an insight into our relationship. My recollection is I went to Moni and I said, Moni, I have this opportunity in Atlanta. I think it's a good opportunity. I would like you to come with me. Her recollection is I went to her and said, I'm going to Atlanta. You can come if you want. We weren't communicating very well. It makes me sad even now to talk about that. The miracle is that she decided to come with me. We had three boys by this time. When we arrived in Atlanta, within a few years, actually, Moni talks about 1981 as being a big year. I had a major business problem. I had some other issues, and my mother died. And I was a senior executive by this point, but I was completely unprepared and ill-equipped to deal with something like that. And that's when I dove into the bottle. You know, I went from drinking every night, but I drank in bars, and I was happy-go-lucky, and I'd take customers out. And overnight, I started drinking at home. And it just kept getting worse. You know, the alcoholics in the room can identify with it, I'm sure. It just kept getting worse. I don't remember ever one time thinking, Mike, tonight I want to drink until I puke. It never occurred to me. That was never a goal of mine. And yet it wasn't until I got here, specifically at the Alcoholics Anonymous, that I understood what happened, because I always wanted to get to that nice place, you know, where the world is rosy, and I could never do it. In fact, we lived in a big house. We had taken our company public, and we built this big house, and my ego was all out of control. And it would be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would be drinking straight bourbon. I'm so drunk I can't stand up, and I would be drinking straight bourbon. I kept puking, and I realized today that was a good thing, because the guys that don't puke have liver damage, and I just got rid of that stuff. Another trick that I had, and I'm going to get sober pretty soon, and this will give you an insight, too, into my thinking. We're pretty successful business-wise. Our net worth is big, and I'm flying around. I wouldn't drink on airplanes, because I never knew what was going to happen. You know, I was one of the owners. I was on a complete expense account. Nobody ever looked at it. I just turned it in. It had nothing to do with money. But if I drank on an airplane, sometimes I could drink with impunity. Sometimes I could drink their little bottles, and nothing bad would happen. And sometimes I would drink one or two, and I would be so drunk I couldn't get off the airplane. And so my solution was just not to drink on the airplane. Here's the crazy thinking. I would stop halfway home, and I always carried alcohol. I could not travel without taking alcohol. And I would stop at a convenience store and somewhere on the way back to the airport. And this is probably, usually it's 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And I would buy some kind of mix, it didn't matter what. I would mix them together and I'd drink it. And my rationale was, well, by drinking it now, it will not get into my bloodstream, so if the highway patrol stops me, I will still be legally sober. It wasn't until I got here that I found out how stupid that thinking was. I I think that I hope I painted a picture of this man. I was successful, you know, in a business sense. I knew a lot of people. That's an interesting point. I knew a lot of people, and I was all by myself. Moni and I weren't getting along. I thought my kids respected me. They feared me. I was alone in the world, and I liked it that way. I didn't need anybody else. I was in St. Louis on October 25th, 19... Actually, it was the 24th. I was at a board meeting, and I came home and caught a late-night flight. I had no idea it was going to be my last drink, my last drunk. I did my usual little trick. Somewhere coming back from the airport, I stopped, and I mixed a drink. I drank more when I got home. There was just nothing special about that drunk. Just absolutely nothing. It was like thousands of other drunks. I did make it to the bedroom that night. Half the time I would get so drunk I couldn't even make it to the bedroom, and I'd pass out on the floor or on a sofa. But that night I made it to the bedroom. And the next morning at 8 o'clock, I still remember, at 8 o'clock, Moni woke me up and she said to my friend Andy, I had one friend in the world, said, Andy's here. And I thought, what the hell is Andy doing here at 8 o'clock in the morning? And I got up and I was stumbling around. I think I was still drunk. And I walked out. Now, we had a big house, and it was a big, great room. And I walked out, and I took one look, and here, the room was full of people. And some of them I knew, and some of them I didn't. And they had flown family members down from Minnesota. There was the local priest was there. And I had read about these damn family interventions, and I knew that's what it was. By the laughter of some of you guys have been through it, huh? Sucks, doesn't it? And what they do in a family intervention, for those that haven't been through it, is they start on one side and they go all the way around. And everybody tells you how much they love you and how your drinking has impacted them. And halfway through, I said, I'll go wherever you want me to go, and they wouldn't. I had to listen to the whole damn thing. And that's how I ended up in Richwood. They put me in a van, and they drove me. I've only failed one breathalyzer test in my whole life, and it's the one when I got here. I thought I was as sober as a judge, an old expression. I thought I was sober. It had been 13 hours. It had been 13 hours since my last drink. I thought I was sober. This is how I ran all my affairs. And I blew a .22. I was almost three times the legal limit for driving, and I thought I was sober. And that's why my thinking about, you know, stopping and getting the mix on the way back from the airport is so stupid. I bet I wasn't legally sober for a decade. You know, I had just built up such tolerance for it. When I got to Ridgeview, a lot of important things happened to me in Ridgeview. You know, first of all, one commentary about treatment. And I don't know if I saw this as completely when I was here as I do today. Being at a place like this is a gift. So many people look at it as punishment, and it's not. At least it wasn't for me. It saved my life. It turned my life around. Everything I have today I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous here at Ridgeview. I told you about my spiritual life when I was young. I guess I should have mentioned that as my behavior deteriorated, I knew, you know, I couldn't jive that with my spiritual values, the ones I had grown up with. And so my solution had been to just ignore God. Well, when I got to Ridgeview, and by the way, the intervention, I should tell you this, my sponsor always said that was my first step. That was my bottom. In my mind, I knew that I had a drinking problem. I think most of us know. There's a few that are in denial, but most of us know. But what I thought I was doing was keeping all the balls in the air. I didn't realize my life was unmanageable. And I had this mental picture of, if I just juggled hard enough, I could keep all the balls in the air. And during that intervention, that's when all the balls fell down. And I clearly saw for the first time, that was my bottom, and that's really when I worked the first step, because I finally realized how unmanageable my life was. And they brought me to Ridgeview, and I went into a group. Now, you have to realize, I knew nothing about AA. I mean, the only thing I knew about AA was how to spell it. And so I was curious what was going to happen. I had no idea. And I don't remember now if it was a group or a meeting, but after it was over, they all put their arms around each other and said the Lord's Prayer. And I had this very clear, I still remember it like it was yesterday. Oh, this is a religious sect. Immediately followed by, well, if that's what it takes, I'm willing to do it because I don't want to drink anymore. And it was that simple surrender. That was my second step. All I did is I let down the barriers. For anybody who knew, this is not a religious sect at all. It's, in fact, the opposite of that. But I was willing to do whatever it required, whatever I had to do. And that was my second step. Now, more stories about Ridgeview. I had a resentment, by the way, early on. I forgot about this until I was thinking about this talk tonight. This good stuff that they had me on for detox, and I don't remember the name, Transine, is that what it was? It was good stuff, I remember that. And I had been sitting in these meetings, and they had been telling me that I shouldn't drink and I shouldn't use drugs. You know, so I'm new, I'm gung-ho. So I went to the nurse, and they had RNs back then, maybe they still do, handing out the medication, and all I said to her was, do I have to take this? Because if I didn't need to take it, I was going to show them I wanted to be sober and I wasn't going to take it. And she said, no. That's all she says, no. So I said, well, if that's the case, then I won't take it. And I got my butt reamed by my attending physician, you know, for taking matters into my own control. And I really wanted to defend myself, because I really had the best intentions of the world. But that's one of the first changes. I didn't. I just, you know, he chewed me out, and I said, all right, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. I didn't counter, I didn't tell about the nurse. I just said, all right. Now, this came up at a treatment center that Moni and I volunteer at. It came up last night, as a matter of fact. One of the things the treatment centers want you to do is surrender. That's not a secret, by the way. And the way they did it was they would make you think you were going to go home. And sound familiar? And then they would spring this, we want you to stay. And in fact, there was a guy here, I was talking to Sam Anders about it, John Cornelius. Does anybody remember John Cornelius? He was a mountain of a man. And he played his role. I mean, I think his group was the last one of my last day before I was staffed. And he said, well, Mike, you know, I understand you're leaving tomorrow. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm out of here. And he said, well, you know, there's somebody I think you should meet. You're a businessman from Stone Mountain, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he gave me a name. He set me up. He gave me a name, and I put it in my wallet. And I'm thinking, I'm going home. And, of course, the next day they staffed me and recommended that I extend and go, I think, to the halfway house and the professionals program. And I threw a real hissy fit. Moni was reminiscing about that tonight. I accused them of all kinds of collusion and plotting. But you know, then I said yes. Then I said, I'll do it. Life went on. I went through all the stuff you do, at least you used to do back then. I went through the professionals program and then R2P2, I think they called it. And then I did the mirroring phase. And I had no idea when I was going to get out. I was there for the long haul, whatever it took. And somewhere toward the end, I got a call from the chairman of our company. And I had a pretty responsible position. And we were in a time-sensitive business. We were doing income tax software and services for CPA firms. And God doesn't wait for the IRS. I mean, so they weren't going to wait for us. And he said, Mike, you know, you have to come back. You know, if you don't come back, it's critical. We'll have to replace you. Now, I haven't spent a lot of time on my business career, but it was the most important thing about me. That if I met you, I would find a way within the first 10 or 15 minutes to let you know how important I was. This is who Mike Sauter was. This business executive. And I prayed about it, and I called him up, and I said, you're going to have to get somebody else. I'm going to stay. I'm more interested in getting well than I am in keeping this job. And that's when I worked the third step. Now, I tried to work this third step before that, but that stands out in my memory so clearly because I had no idea what was going to happen. You know, I'd spent the last 20 years in this with this company and this business. I'd grown it from a one-man operation up to a pretty large national organization. And yet, when I made that decision, it was like a huge weight was lifted off of me. And I was just going to do whatever they told me to do. Shortly thereafter, Moni called me. And we had two teenage sons at home. We have three sons. One was off with the Navy. He's a Navy pilot. But the other two were at home. And there was some issue. And neither one of us today can remember what the issue was. But I had to go home. We decided it would be best if I went home to deal with it. And so I went to my community. I assume they do that kind of stuff. You can't scratch your butt without the community's permission. Is that still the case? And the community said, well, we understand. You can go. But two things. You have to be back by curfew, and you have to go to an AA meeting. Well, this is DeKalb County I think it was very early 1991 now. And it was a Thursday night, and there are meetings all over the place. There must have been 20 meetings. And I picked the Clarkston group. I just picked it out of the schedule. And the Clarkston group was very active, and they still are. And they had meetings at noon and 2 and 4 and 6 and 8 and 10. And I picked the 8 o'clock meeting. And this is when the Clarkston group was on Lewis Road. It was a very unique facility. I think it had been an old insurance office. And where the secretaries and the filing cabinets were, that big area, that's where the seats were, and we had the announcements. And then all around it were the individual offices. And we would break into intimate little AA meetings. I saw the group, those were new, the group rooms back here. It was like that. You know, you could fit 8 or 10 or 12 people in there. And there were 13 rooms. And I picked number 7. I do remember that. And I walked in. And I guess I shared a little bit about whatever had happened with the boys, because this tall gentleman said, my name's Gordon Bailey. He said, I'd like to speak to you. He turns out he had three daughters of roughly the age of my three sons. And he had a successful business just like I did. He lived half a mile from me. His sobriety date was October 29th, and mine was October 25th. He had been married at that time 26 years, and I'd been married 24 years. And then I found out his birthday was the same as mine. We were both born on November 10th. And I thought, oh, maybe God is telling me something here. And so I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And he said yes, and he laid out some rules for me. And I had to leave because I had to be back to Ridgeview for curfew. And on the way back, I remembered those months before that John Cornelius had given me the name of somebody I had to meet. And I pulled it out of my wallet, and the name was Gordon Bailey. And Gordon is still my sponsor. You know, I figured when God puts a relationship like that together, I'm not going to do anything about it. I don't see Gordon anywhere near as often. He is retired and is traveling the world doing charity work. He's been very successful. And so I've augmented him with a co-sponsor. Gordon will always be my number one sponsor. Now, One day my attending came to me and he said, Mike, I think you're ready to leave. I'm here to tell you, I didn't wait for the next day. I was out of here that afternoon. I mean, I love virtue, but I don't love it that much. And I went home, and Moni had been, we'd been married 24 years by this time, and I had put her through a lot of pain, but she had been asking me for years to quit drinking. I finally made the great sacrifice. I quit drinking. You would think the woman would be happy, wouldn't you? I got home and I was married to the wife from hell. If I said up, she said down. If I said left, she said right. I mean, I couldn't do anything right. We both remember an incident. To give you an idea of what it was like. And this is a Ridgeview story, by the way. You know, when I was here, you had group therapy and family therapy and individual therapy. And one of those therapies, we were taught how to fight. That when you're having a dispute, you should deal in feeling words. You know, I feel, when you do this, I feel, however you feel, angry or sad. And so we're going at it. It's not important, but I don't even remember what we were arguing about, but we're going at it. And I got on my high horse. And I said, I don't hear you using any feeling words. And she looked me in the eye and she said, all right, I feel you're an asshole. I'd like to tell you that those difficult years passed quickly. They didn't. I had a very strong sponsor, and he helped me through those years. He explained to me that I was the cause of a lot of the anger and discomfort on Moni's part, and that my amends, part of my amends, was to give her the time and the space she needed to deal with these feelings. And I'm very, very fortunate that Moni, I call her my black belt Al-Anon. She has been in Al-Anon since before I got sober, and it works out just a superb program. We disagree about this. I say things got better after 3.5 years. And I think it had to do with Moni's step work. That's my guess. I've never really asked her, but I think that at that point, you know, I asked her once, why does it take Al-Anon so long to do a inventory? And she told me that the first 3 years she was too busy doing my inventory to do her own. Moni says it was 5 years. I'm going to stick with 3.5. I like 3.5. I have been asking her now. By this point, we were married 24 years when I got sober. I think I told you that. And every year I asked Moni, let's go reaffirm our vows. Let's do something. And she wouldn't do it. She told me later she didn't know if she was going to stay. She wasn't going to go through something like that. And for our 30th wedding anniversary, she brought it to me. She said, let's go through it again. And that crappy wedding that we had when we were 19 years old, we did it ourselves this time. You know, and I was an active participant. I went around. I liked the tasting of the cake. That was fun. And the worst part was the cards, because they all looked the same. But we picked up all that stuff just like young people do. And we invited our friends. The minister who presided was my roommate here at Ridgeview. Our clubhouse, our country club, we filled it up with our friends in AA and Al-Anon. We brought our original attendance from 1966 down. Moni wore her original wedding gown. How do you guys like that? I wore the same kind of tux. You know, this is where it gets hard for me, because my life today is so good, and I don't want to take a huge amount of time, but I do want to relate a few things to you. My children. I should spend a few moments telling you about my children. I have one son that he and I were just, we fought all the time from his earliest moments. They tell me he's exactly like me. I don't see that, but everybody else apparently does. And I tried to work the ninth step with him, and I couldn't. You know, I was just, and I realized in working with my sponsor, I was still so angry that I had to go back and work the six and seven steps on him. And when I did that, I was then able to make amends to him. But here's the interesting part. We still didn't get along. I mean, I was all right, but he was still angry. And it was 2 or 3 years later that he came to me and he said, I've watched what AA has done for you, Dad. And he said, I think I have a drinking problem. And I got to take him to his first AA meeting. I spoke at his first birthday. He's chosen a different course. You know, one of the things, here's another thing that I've learned. You just can't hear the message of AA from family. I don't say anything to him. He doesn't drink. He hasn't had a drink in, I think, 18 years. I'm not 100% sure. And I would love for him to get back into recovery, but, you know, there's not a damn thing I can do about it. And so all we can do, Moni and I, is just love him and wait. I did go on an intervention with one of my brothers, and it is better to give than to receive there, I'll tell you that. And he got sober, and there again, it worked for a while. My understanding is that he's been on the marijuana maintenance program for the last 10 years. But the mistake that I made is I truly wanted to help him early on, and I would call him, and I would tell him my experience, strength, and hope. And I was speaking as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all he heard was his big brother talking to him. And I learned there again, it's just so hard to hear this from family. One of the gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety has given me is my relationship with my father. Now, I told you he was a working class man. He was just a wonderful guy. He was he gained weight as he got older, but he was like Santa Claus, you know, with the rosy cheeks and the white hair. And he had the most pleasing personality. And he'd walk into a room and you would just like him. I mean, that's the way it was. And I made more money the day I got out of college. I made more money than that man made in his entire life. And with the arrogance of youth, I thought he should have been a salesman. He should have taken those skills and made money, mostly so I could have the things that I wanted when I was growing up. I didn't talk a lot about that. But I seem to be more sensitive to that kind of stuff than my other brothers. I've got five brothers. And so I was never ashamed of him, but I was disappointed in him. That's the words that I used, especially when I was young. And when I got sober, he was up in Minneapolis and we were down here, and I would go back and stay with him. And that's all he wanted, was for me to go up and spend time with him. I had 4.5 years of spending time with him. We got a call. Moni, I had just gotten back from a trip, and we got a call that he had died of a heart attack. And two things. One is I was able to, they asked me to eulogize him, and I did. And they didn't know it. The people out there didn't know it, but all I talked about was AA principles. I talked about how God doesn't really care about when we die. He's not going to ask us, did you get the promotion or the new car or the big house? What God's going to ask us is, did you enjoy the life I gave you? Did you enjoy the life I gave you? And I said, my father could look God right in the eye and say, yes, sir, I most certainly did. And the other thing that happened is I saw all these people. Now, my father was a very humble man. It was in March. If you've ever been to Minnesota in March, it can be very cold. And so many people came to say goodbye to this simple old man that they lined out of the room, down the hall, outside and into the parking lot. And I realized then, and I realized much more now, that he had the right values, that my values were the ones that were screwed up. We are very active. I guess I should close with this. I'm starting to run out of time. How much time do I have? As much as I want. I'm Irish. I can talk to the wall. 5 minutes. Okay, I'll wrap it up. Today I'm very active in AA. You know, one other thing I wanted to mention. I told Sam this. We were talking about it, and this is nothing to do with my clothes or anything. But you know what the prime motivation for me working the steps and working this program was? And I worked it really hard when I was new. I still work it very hard, by the way. But when I was newly sober, you know what motivated me? It was fear. I did not want to drink. And I was afraid if I didn't do everything they told me that I would drink. And so I did. I didn't always like it. That's the insight I've had after almost 23 years now, is willingness doesn't mean wanting to do it. It just means doing it. It's just easier to do it if you want to do it. But at the end of the day, it's did you do what you were told to do? I go to lots of meetings. I sponsor lots of men. I'm still very active. I go to as many meetings today as I did when I was new. And I'm on not a rigid schedule, but I'm on a schedule. If it's Monday night, you know where Mike Sauter's going to be. If it's Wednesday or it's Thursday or it's Friday, you know where I'm going to be. I've been sober long enough that if something comes up, I can afford to miss a couple of meetings. But if there's nothing else going on, that's where I am. I'm in AA meetings. And I'm no longer there because I'm scared. It's not fear-based anymore. It's my life. Moni and I should tell you this. Moni and I made the decision early on, even when we weren't getting along, that we were going to make recovery the center post of our relationship. And for the last 22 and a half years, that has been the case. When I was asked to speak for the first time, I always close with this story because it is so true, that I went to... it was at a group, not important, I guess. It was on Memorial Drive over in Stone Mountain. And at that time, there were lots of speaker meetings. The groups were competing with each other for new members. And so what they all thought was, we'll have a speaker meeting and attract new people. And they were all speaker meetings. And so we all got a chance to speak a lot. But the first time I was asked to speak, I just assumed they recognized a superior program of recovery and wanted to hear how I did it. I outlined it and I timed it and I did all the things that you do, but I had a fear. I had seen guys get up there and tell their story, and there might be 10 or 15 minutes of, they'd finish and there would be 10 or 15 minutes of time left on the clock. And they would stumble around, and it was painful, and hem and haw. So I went to Gordon, and I said, Gordon, what do I do if I've said everything that I want to say, and there's still time on the clock? And he looked at me with pity in his eyes, and he said, Mike, sit down. So I want to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you tonight. With that, I'm going to sit down.
Thank you, Mike. That's an awesome job. Thank you. Mike gave us a lot of hope.